Hello, everybody, and welcome to Talking Flutes Extra with me, Jean-Paul Wright. And again this week, in part three of this series, is forensic psychologist Dr. Beth Wright. Hello, Beth.
Hi again.
Hello. Hi. What's the best way to? Is hello a bit too officious?
It's too formal.
Hey. Hi. Hi, Beth. Right. One of the questions that have been sent in this week is, I think this is really interesting, and I think it really affects musicians of all standards. And that's even those that are used to playing to thousands and thousands of people. And I'm not talking about performance anxiety. I'm talking about the difference between stress and anxiety and being aware of the trigger points to enable us to either cope with it rather than turning it into this recursive pressure cooker. Really, what is stress? What is anxiety? And what do we need to be aware of when those sort of funny feelings arise?
Yeah, so stress and anxiety, some people often kind of use the terms interchangeably, and they're similar in a sense, but they're also distinct experiences. When we talk about feeling stressed, it's more of an acute reaction in response to a certain situation. I think I spoke about this in a previous podcast, but it's very much linked to our fight or flight response. So those kind of core caveman physiological responses that we have that tells us we are in danger, that something bad's going to happen, that I'm not safe. And our body goes into sort of a stress response. So it releases cortisol that raises our heart rates. We get sweaty. And like, as I said, it's in response to usually a triggering situation or a specific situation that happens. And it's an acute response. So it's a short-term response. When we are thinking about anxiety, it's often more of a longer-term difficulty. It's a clinical issue. Anxiety disorder is a diagnosable disorder. We can also experience anxiety outside of something diagnosable, but it's often more long-term and more about our way of thinking. So what often comes with anxiety is overthinking or excessive worrying, catastrophizing, thinking that the worst case scenario is going to happen. And it's more of a prolonged experience. So if we think about stress being acute and specific to a situation, anxiety is more of a constant state of being.
So can we address first the stressors? Mm-hmm. I suppose stressors, listening to what you just said then, stressors are probably self-induced, aren't they? Because when it comes to music and our performance, it would be a pending deadline, a pending performance, would it? It will be a pending lesson. It would be, would we be causing the stress ourselves? Or could it naturally? I understand the anxiety bit. We'll cover that in a second. But stress.
So stress is something, the stress response is something that we don't necessarily have full control over because it is a fight or flight response.
Oh, okay.
So it's often induced by a specific situation rather than self-induced. Whereas I think, I guess where you're speaking to is anxiety, which is we can get ourselves tangled up in our own worries that actually never have happened, never will happen. But there's a 0.0001% chance that something might happen.
So it could be going to your teacher each week and your teacher being grumpy, always being a perfectionist or always demanding a lot of you. You're going to build, the stress will build up the closer you need to go to your lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I understand that bit then.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and different people are going to feel stressed or be triggered to feel stressed by specific situations. That might not phase, that example that you gave might not phase some people. Mm. They might go, well, I'll go and I'll do what I can and I don't really care what Sharon thinks about my performance, you know. And other people might ride on Sharon's opinion.
I don't know any flute teachers called Sharon, but go on.
Okay. We're running with it now.
Yeah, okay.
They might, you know, hold Sharon in really high regard and put her on a pedestal and go, you know, I really want Sharon to think that I'm the best flute player that she's got and be her best student. And again, we're eking into sort of worrying and rumination here. But
so does rumination happen as soon as the stress response begins? Do you then sort of start ruminating because you're feeling a little bit anxious?
So this is where I said they can sometimes come hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So we might experience the stress response because there is a stressful situation. We can't kid ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say going up onto the stage and performing can be stressful for people. We can't change that and just say, well, don't be stressed about it.
No.
But you're right, that can evolve and sort of metamorphosize into rumination and excessive worry about that could be anything, whatever meaning we make from that stressful situation. I'm going to mess up. I'm not going to be good enough. What if I play this wrong? There's someone in the audience that I really want to impress. There's this, there's that, you know, and it can sort of evolve into anxiety.
Is anxiety an evolution or the recursive loop of a number of stressors, or can it be something very different?
Yeah, I think anxiety is a sort of certainly a combination or a complex sort of combination of lots of different things, really. That anxiety doesn't tend just to be surface level. There tends to be something deep rooted that causes us to cling on to or hold on to certain unhelpful patterns or of thinking or unhelpful beliefs that we have about ourselves, the world or other people. Yeah, there is often a combination of things that can cause us to feel anxiety long term. And as well, remember as well, physiologically, anxiety can present very similarly to stress. We can feel that sort of heart racing, mm-hmm. that butterflies in our tummy. We're not hungry, we feel sick. Our digestive system is all, you know, fumbly and muddled up, and we feel sweaty, and it can present in very similar ways to stress. I'd say anxiety, it's evolved sort of modern day. If you think about the things that we are anxious about, often they never come to fruition. But equally, we might be anxious about things that are about our kind of fundamental needs, thinking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Am I going to lose my house? Am I going to mm-hmm. be able to pay the bills? You know, I don't know if that's answered your question, but anxiety can evolve for a number of different reasons, and it can evolve in many different ways and present in a few different forms.
If someone has anxiety, they will be aware they have anxiety.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. If you think about somebody that is in a constant sort of fight or flight response, they're probably not able to access the part of their brain, or they may not be able to access the part of their brain that allows them to really sit with and think about what is going on for them in that moment. How are they actually feeling? What's happening here? They might just know that they're not feeling good and, you know, be kind of responding or trying to kind of just get through each day as best they can. And some people might struggle with the language. They might not know actually what is anxiety? What is that what I'm experiencing? We kind of assume this knowledge, don't we, that this must be, people must know what that is or what that feels like, or it's really super easy to spot, but it's not always super easy to spot, particularly because often a lot of people with anxiety are high functioning as well. So they can go on their daily life. They're presenting very...
That's interesting. You
know, yeah, absolutely. So we might have this idea in our head that somebody that is anxious, they're not going to go out, or they're not never going to perform, or they're never going to, you know, do this, that and the other. And yeah, you can have somebody that experiences anxiety, but it's high functioning.
Does exploration with a professional in the field of cognitive behavioral therapy, is that useful for anyone listening that is aware that they have anxiety issues?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think even if you can't label what you're experiencing as anxiety, if you're not feeling good, go and see someone. That's what I would say. Doesn't matter if you don't have a label for it, or if you don't know what it is that you're experiencing, seeing a professional can be really helpful. And for anxiety specifically, cognitive behavioural therapy can be really helpful, because what we know is that anxiety is fueled by unhelpful, maladaptive patterns of thinking, kind of core beliefs that are quite negative or unhelpful. And so being able to identify, okay, what is the cognition, what is the thought that is keeping those uncomfortable feelings there, keeping that sort of, yeah, that anxiety going, and how is that impacting on my behaviour and what I choose to do or not do, or what I choose to avoid or don't avoid, what I choose to control or don't control. So, yeah, cognitive behavioural therapy can be really eye-opening in identifying those patterns that often we don't know are existing, Yeah, and just being able to speak to someone and someone to say, oh gosh, that sounds really tricky actually what you're experiencing, and just have somebody to talk it through with, dissect, untangle, really life-changing.
Now, I know you're a passionate advocate of everybody speaking to somebody. And I know that you think, well, you believe that in America, where the idea of going to therapy is, it's not uncommon. It doesn't mean you've got a problem. You could just be going to have just a detox, because we all need to detox, don't we? But I know we're in the UK, and going to therapy would normally mean that you have a problem. Why should we, and especially performing musicians, where we have stresses hitting us all the time, why should we either go to therapy or have a close unit of friends that we can just talk to if we feel that we have an issue?
I think that people think that therapy is about digging into the deepest, darkest part of your soul, and you're going to be laid bare and exposed and going to have to talk about really scary stuff in your life.
That's why I won't do it.
Yeah, I know. You know, there's this assumption that it's going to be something that you don't want to embark on. And the truth is that therapy is what you make of it. It can be whatever you want it to be. And you're right. America has a really open, proactive approach to therapy. But I think it's just some shame around it in the UK. Like you said, there's just this taboo, this assumption that you've got really deep-rooted issues if you've got to go to therapy. And the fact of the matter is that you can explore anything and everything in therapy, and you don't have to go, you know, below that iceberg if that doesn't feel comfortable. But equally, you might find a channel that's worth exploring that might explain a lot of what you're feeling, or it might explain, resolve a lot of things for you to allow you to develop as a musician. So, as we said, I'm a massive advocate for therapy, whether it's sort of low-level difficulties, whether it's just actually I feel fine, but I just want to learn more about myself and what cogs I've got going on up there and how they're turning and why they're turning.
In your experience, is it men that are more reluctant to seek out therapy because we sort of hold our emotions and our feelings and our worries internally? Or, as you say, in your experience, is it less of a weighting against men?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that there is a sense that obviously the macho masculine personality or person, it kind of shapes the belief that big men don't cry, and the only emotion that you can feel is anger, and that's a powerful emotion, and we should only feel that. And you see a lot of displaced sad, you know, people that feel kind of macho masculine or feel like they have to be that big, you know, big bad guy that doesn't show any feelings. You see a lot of misplaced feelings, or, you know, secondary feelings, where all the other feelings that they don't feel are masculine enough to express get evolved or shaped into anger or something that looks like that. And I think we're talking more about it now in terms of male mental health, and, you know, and trying to encourage more conversations about how men feel, and enabling men to feel more comfortable in talking about their emotions. And I still think we've got a long way to go. I think women have been doing it since the age of time, haven't they? That they've been talking about how they feel about things, and it's been a lot more accepted to discuss with girlfriends and, you know, other, you know, female friends to discuss how we're feeling, discuss emotions, that it's second nature. For men, I think it's not always been that way. I'm not going to sort of generalise, but, you know, for a lot of men, it's not always been the sort of default to talk about how they feel, or even to identify, connect with how they feel. So certainly I think there is a more of a reluctance to enter into therapy as a man, generally speaking. It's not for everybody, but just generally because of how our society, our culture has shaped our sense or belief about men and that kind of toxic masculinity that prevented men from talking about how they feel or seeking help when they need it.
So circling back to the original question, if we were to be more open with, if we're struggling with something, we're struggling with our thoughts and the stress is in danger of becoming an anxiety, if we notice somebody, one of our friends or one of our colleagues, beginning to show the symptoms of struggling, what should we do? Should we, how do we approach them? And when you know that they are struggling and you know it's a stress or you know it's an anxiety, because it can't be an easy thing just to go up and say, hi, you're struggling, mate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it depends on the quality of that relationship and how you know that person and how close you are to that person, because you would never want to put that person in a position where they're like, oh my gosh, my soul has been laid bare and I don't even know this person. But equally, it might feel less threatening to send a text like, mate, you don't have to reply to this, but I've noticed something's been a bit off. I'm here for you if you need anything. Equally, if you're just having a bad week or I've completely got this wrong, then just let me know. But here for you if you need to talk about anything. I think it's just about being present for people, allowing them to know that you are there if they need them. And equally, if you're somebody that is experiencing that anxiety, then it can be scary to reach out to somebody. It can be daunting. It can feel like, oh my goodness, I'm going to be put on medication. I'm going to be pushed into pushed into therapy, or my friends aren't going to understand, or they're not going to listen to me, or I don't actually feel like I have anybody that I could share this with. You know, first and foremost, there are people out there that they don't have to be your friends and family. There are professionals out there through the NHS or privately that you can go to just lessen that burden. But equally, sort of self-work, so journaling, writing down what you're experiencing, scribbling on a piece of paper if you can't find the words for it, can all be helpful in trying to untangle what you're experiencing. And sometimes finding the words can be difficult, and you don't always have to have that available to you, particularly if your head is just full of a lot of mess.
Why do we regard it as a sign of weakness if we are struggling? Is it a man thing again, or is that sort of too generic?
It's a big question. I guess what comes straight to my mind is that being vulnerable is scary. And what does that mean about me if I'm vulnerable? It's exposing. Oh, how is it going to be received to other people? We don't know.
On a stage, we're vulnerable, aren't we? Because we're there.
Yep. And this is, I think this is across the board, men and women, but sometimes it feels safer if we just keep everything locked away in that brain for nobody to see. But then it builds up and we think it's this ugly monster. And then when you actually get it out to a friend or family member or professional, it's actually not that big or not that scary, not as scary as we thought it was. But it's sort of, we feed it. It's like a monster in our brain that we feed every time we lock it away. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it sort of overtakes everything in our mind. But
So in your practice, do you find people come to you that have compartmentalized stuff and pushed it away, thinking that it's buried and it's not?
You can tell quite quickly in therapy when there's things that are buried, or I like to think that I'm able to tell quite quickly when, yeah, just being able to notice when there's things that are really not too accessible. And that's not to say that we should always dig up those skeletons, but equally there's something quite powerful about doing that in a safe place and overextended length of time. It's a defense mechanism at the end of the day, compartmentalizing and pushing something away that's uncomfortable. It's a defense mechanism, and a really bloody good one, actually, to be fair, excuse my language. It can be really helpful for us sometimes to compartmentalize and to put that thing that we're scared about or anxious about, that, you know, that monster, to lock it away. It can be really helpful because it means that we're high functioning, we can get on with the rest of our life, that can become the background noise. But what happens is it shouts louder and louder and louder and louder until it no longer becomes a background noise. It becomes everything that, and it takes over. And that's
But why does it jump out at really stupid moments? That's got, in a situation that's got absolutely nothing to do with you compartmentalizing it years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it just sort of jump out and cause anxiety and stress?
It's its favorite thing, isn't it? To like scare you when you least expect it. To just go bam, like I'll just whack you with this when you least expect it. Because if we were to expect it, we could control it, couldn't we? It jumps out, and maybe it's something that's triggered it. Maybe it's something unconscious, subconscious that it's tapped into. We don't always know why these things might come out at certain times, but there is often a reason. But equally, we like to think that we have control over the these things that we compartmentalize. I'm in control of it. I'm just going to push it to the back of our mind. But the fact that it jumps out at times that we least expect it shows that we often don't have that much control over it.
So talking is the baseline for the a potential reduction in stressors and ultimately anxiety. Whether you're talking to a friend or you're talking to a therapist, if you do that, then you're giving yourself a bit of mental gap in which to work in, rather than giving space for this thing that sits on your shoulder waiting to come out.
You're inviting that monster in the room into the room with you, aren't you? You're saying, right, come on in. You know what we like to do is we like to slam the door on it, don't we? It's like ringing the doorbell, like constantly. Like, let me in. And you just ignore it for a while. You put your AirPods in. But then it comes the next day with a hammer and starts smashing the door down and think, oh, gosh, this is a lot. And we could have avoided the broken door by inviting it in and having a cup of coffee with it and just going, like, why are you here? Just say what you need to say and it will say what it needs to say and you'll go, oh, okay. So that's it then. Okay, let me work out how I'm going to deal with this. And then it will go and it will leave and you're giving it its time.
Hang on a second. I'm getting something here. So when you get this anxiety, this thought coming through that may be nothing to do with the anxiety, or it may be, you're saying talk to it or try to understand the narrative that it's giving. And by understanding that and not pushing it away, you're beginning to decrease its relevance.
So it can be helpful. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's not always the solution for everybody. But for those that tend to push away or compartmentalize their issues, and
that's a lot of us here.
That's where I would say try or practice inviting it in. And again, depending on what the demon is, you might want to do that, you know, with yourself, with friends, with a professional. Yeah, depending on how safe that's going to be for you. You know, for those that are overthinkers or ruminators, inviting it in for a cup of coffee is not going to be too helpful because it's not going to leave.
No.
So
it's like that friend that doesn't go, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You're watching the clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, every person is different and the way that they cope or the way what they find helpful to manage is going to be different for everybody. But I think ultimately it's about noticing or being aware of the things that make you feel better and things that make things worse, getting a sense of that for you. Because again, that's going to be different for everybody. I could recommend you do A, B, C, X, Y, and Z, but unless I know you as a person and unless you know yourself or start to learn what's going to be helpful for you, you're not going to be able to sort of move forward. So
what I'm getting from this is, if you feel that your stress or anxiety levels, and again, I'm putting them both together and I shouldn't do, but you're aware of those and you're aware that there's certain points and certain times, being awareness is the critical factor here, then if it's building up, then the importance is seeking help, because ultimately it will impact you not only as a musician, but also as a human being. So it's not vulnerable, it's not a weakness to seek help, to talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to talk to people, talk to friends. If you're feeling rubbish, you're feeling as though you haven't prepped well enough, talk to people, get it out, which, as you've already said, potentially diminishes its effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't one size fits all.
Yes, so you're going to want to circuit break sooner rather than later. Because the longer that you let this thing sit, it's going to impact on your relationships, it's going to impact on your work, it's going to impact on your thoughts and feelings towards yourself. It's going to impact on so many areas of life, your sleep. It's really just going to impact on so many areas of life. So being able to circuit break that sooner rather than later by talking to somebody that's going to sit and listen and support you. That's the key thing. Don't sit and talk to somebody that's toxic in your life, because you're not going to...
Oh, that's a totally different subject,
isn't
it? Yeah,
that is. But somebody that you trust and that cares about you, or that can be a friend, family member or therapist, sooner rather than later, it's going to circuit break it quicker and it's going to impact on your life less.
And if somebody comes to you, sit and listen and don't give advice. Just sit and listen and allow them just to voice their concerns.
Yeah, and just being human and showing some compassion and, you know, just being... being there for them. We're all guilty of wanting to, well, some of us more than others, are guilty of wanting to fix things straight away.
You're looking at me there, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so many people will relate to this, but wanting to, seeing someone you love in pain or, you know, not feeling good, it's so uncomfortable that you just want to fix it. I'll do this, I can do that, you can do this, you know. And actually, often someone's not wanting a solution. They're just wanting to feel heard and for somebody to go, you know, to say, that sounds rubbish. It sounds like you're having a rubbish time and I'm sorry you're having to experience this. And that can be enough for somebody. So yeah, so try and refrain from trying to fix. And if in doubt, ask that person, what do you need from me right now? Because I have a few solutions that I could offer, or I can just give you a hug and sit with you whilst you're feeling what you're feeling. If in doubt, ask what they need and they will tell you, because I'm sure they know.
I like that. Somebody comes to you, then listen and then ask them.
Yeah, if in doubt, mm-hmm. You know, maybe they might say, they might end their rant or their offload with, you know, what do you think I should do? And you know then what they're asking for. They're asking for your opinion or advice. Or if they just say, you know, it's just so rubbish, this is so hard. They're wanting to you to validate and offer compassion. They're not wanting a solution. So yeah, pick up on some of those subtleties in what they're saying to give them what they need.
Beth, thank you.
Talking Flutes and Talking Flutes Extra are podcast productions by the Trevor James Flute Company. For more information, visit trevorjamesflutes.com.